Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for coming along this morning. I appreciate it greatly on a Saturday morning. It is a little bit like coming home for me. I grew up in Blackburn, on Blackburn Road, just on the corner of Heath Street, so just on the other side of the railway line. And also went up to Blackburn Baptist Church for many years. And also lived for a number of years in a shared house on Kunung Road, where the rent we paid was $60 a week. So that tells you how long ago it was. And it's also good to catch up with a number of people here this morning from uni days, from World Vision days, and also from Bill in terms of being with CBM. So there's a few things I'll tell you about myself in the course of this talk, but also just so that you know, I think I'm about the same vintage as most people here, and these days, although I grew up in Blackburn, I now live in North Carlton. I'm married. I've got two grown-up daughters in their 30s. And unfortunately, I'm not a grandfather yet, so that's the one area that's still, I'm missing out. I'm ready to start an organisation called Grandparents Without Grandkids, but I also want to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land that we're meeting on. It's the Wurundjeri people who are part of the Kulin Nation. And they cared for this land for tens of thousands of years as good stewards of God's creation. And I want to pay respect to elders past and present. One thing you might not know is that Ngunnawatting means something in the language of the Wurundjeri people. Apparently, it can mean either battlefield or a ceremonial meeting ground. And this was the place where the Wurundjeri people used to come together, particularly close to the Yarra River. So it's appropriate that we're meeting in Ngunnawatting. But I do hope it's going to be a ceremonial breakfast rather than a place of battle for us. I want to tell you a little bit about, use a lens, I guess, in terms of my story, of a particular event or set of circumstances in my life that had a big impact, and talk you through what happened and what I learned out of it, but also to say it's not the only story about my life. It's just I thought it would be interesting to present it this way, and to use it as a chance to kind of reflect on a few things. But it was all about something that happened in 2001. I was working for World Vision at the time, and I left World Vision because I'd been offered the best job in the world. It was high profile. It was a fantastic opportunity. I had a chance to have all kinds of impact at a national level, and it felt like a natural trajectory of my career. I felt, yes, this is where I was meant to be, and I had a strong sense of call. In fact, a friend wrote to me when he heard that I'd got this job, and he quoted Luke 4:18, that verse that says, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me because he's anointed me to proclaim freedom for prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, and to set the oppressed free." So kind of high expectations, as you can see from that. And I also had that sense, I was reminded at the time of that verse from Jeremiah 29, where it says, "For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future." And it seemed as though in the classic, four spiritual laws thing, there was a plan laid out, in terms of a blueprint, a master framework of what was going to happen with my life. So I had high expectations, as did everybody else. And in early 2001, I started in that role. But I have to say that within a year, everything had fallen into a heap. And there was a mutual parting of ways. But for me, it was a shattering experience. I came to realize fairly quickly that it was an organization that I think could only be described as toxic. There was a lot of distrust, suspicion, an inability, conflict, inability to work together. And it also felt for me, despite my management experience, that there was nothing I could do that was right. It always seemed to be wrong, and I didn't seem to be able to have any impact in changing the culture. And I'll be honest with you, I felt very insecure as a result of those 12 months or so, a bit lost and bullied. And perhaps that's not a term that we like to use, but you know, I wouldn't have named it that way in the time, but looking back, I think there was a sense of bullying in that culture. Now, my first natural inclination was to blame myself. It was my fault. I was the one who'd made all the mistakes. I was the one who was in the wrong. And then as part of that, to start reflecting and to say, oh, look, if only I'd spoken up this way, if only I'd named that behaviour, if I only had done this or not done that, it would have worked out. And it's hard not to get locked into that mode of thinking of that, if only, I should have done this, I should have done that, I shouldn't have done this. But it ended up, as I found out eventually, like a very, there was no single solution about something else that I could or couldn't have done. It just worked out that it didn't work out, if you like. So there was a huge sense of failure that sat heavily on me. And it took about 2 or 3 years for me to work through. I kept going on the outside, in a sense. I kept getting up in the morning. I was able to find other work. But I would also say that I carried a sense of brokenness for some period of time. So what happened to that sense of call? You know, those verses that I quoted from Jeremiah and from Luke. Did I get it wrong? Was the calling real? Or was there something else? What was going on? And I spent a long time trying to think through the spiritual or the religious dimension of it. And in that time, I was actually reminded of another verse from Jeremiah, one that perhaps isn't quoted as much as Jeremiah 29:11, but comes from Jeremiah 20, verse 7. And it follows this whole set of paragraphs and verses where God asks Jeremiah to speak up, to name things, to do things, to be a prophet to the people of Israel. And it falls in a heap for him. And I think he ends up in the stock. And Jeremiah 20, verse 7, actually has Jeremiah saying back to God, "You deceived me, Lord, and I was deceived. You overpowered me and prevailed. I am ridiculed all day long. Everyone mocks me." And what I found out is that word deceived actually is the same word as seduced. So quite literally, Jeremiah is saying to God, "You seduced me. And I was deceived. You overpowered me." And from my background in terms of an evangelical Christian upbringing, I have to say that we're not used to using such open, direct, forceful, angry language back to God. It's shocking. But for me, it was also reassuring that that's something that's there in the scriptures. And that was the way that the prophet Jeremiah, it was the only way at that time that he felt he could talk to God. So it was kind of ironically reassuring to me that although I couldn't make sense of what had happened and seemed incredibly murky, and while I was still struggling with that sense of failure, at least I could complain openly, directly, and repeatedly to God about it. And that was okay to do that. It was, in a sense, that was the right thing to do. I was also reassured at the time that this sense of abandonment that I felt was something that Jesus felt too. And again, we're reminded that one of the last things that Jesus said on the cross was, my God, why have you abandoned me?" Speaking in anguish, speaking in that same sense of abandonment. And it seems to me that sometimes we can jump too quickly to that sense of the risen, glorious Christ and we do lose sight that that resurrection and that victory only happened through a process of abandonment and deep despair. I believe that going through that experience, with all its pain and struggle, that I've been able to become a different person as a result, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But I think the experience actually, the only way I can describe it is kind of took me apart, piece by piece, almost to be laid out so that then those pieces could be put back in a different way. And it allowed me to grow, to change, and to work on different aspects of my character and my life. It certainly felt like that image that, again, is in the Bible of the refining fire, where the dross gets burnt off, and I realised that there was some dross in my life. I don't think I could say that God deliberately planned all the events as if he was going to, you know, had somehow mapped out a maze that I would work my way through. But I do recognise that the events gave me an opportunity through God's strength and through God's grace to change, to repent. Not in the sense of, you know, the going up to the you know, responding to an altar call, but to repent in the Greek sense of the word, of that turning around, of that transformation, remembering that repentance is a continuous process that we're always called into, and in the process to try and become more Christ-like. I was very fortunate that new directions opened up for me. I was able, if you like, to press the reset button and to actually try different things that I otherwise wouldn't have contemplated, I think, if I'd kept on going in that trajectory. My next job after that was for a much smaller organisation, but a very exciting organisation called the Westgate Health Co-op. And the Westgate Health Co-op was significant because it was a medical clinic that the church I was involved in, Westgate Baptist Community, set up in the western suburbs, which at the time had very poor medical services. And the church said, what does this area need? It needs doctors. And they set up a clinic. But rather than keeping the clinic owned by or run by the church or by the Baptist Union, they eventually handed it over to the community, and it became a cooperative. And so it, at the time that I was working there or managing it, it had 10,000 members of the cooperative who were the patients. They owned their own health service. It had two clinics, 12 doctors, two dentists, paramedics and other health services, allied health services. And it was a unique model. It still is just about, I think, unique, except that I'm pleased to say that another group, I think Assemblies of God group in the ACT, came and saw the model, said, this is fantastic, this is what we need in Western Canberra. And they've duplicated it and have now got a similar co-op. I think they've got something like 10 clinics, including one in Yass. And working for the Westgate Health Co-op, as I said, gave me a chance to press the reset button. But it gave me a chance to be involved in what I think was a very interesting, exciting organisation. It reminded me of my management skills, which I was struggling to think that I still had any. And I'm also pleased to say, by the way, that that health cooperative has kept on going. It was going through a difficult time when I was involved, but it's just gone from strength to strength. And if you want to know any more about it at some stage, I'd be happy to tell you. But it's now in a very strong financial position. That also led to the chance to go overseas. So, which again, I don't think I would have had that chance if I kept on going at the career that I was originally thinking about. So in 2006, my wife and I stopped waiting for our children to leave home, and we decided to leave home. We headed off to Timor, East Timor, and had an amazing experience living there for 3.5 years. It was physically stressful, but it was an amazing experience to be in East Timor, again at a very interesting time, because I don't know if you remember 2006 is when the government collapsed and there was something like 150,000 people running around Dili and camped out under in parks and churches and so on. So to be there part as part of that. And I guess I recognize that my earlier experience, despite the difficulties and my sense of failure and mistakes, actually had helped me become a better manager when I went to work with other people in East Timor. I still made lots of mistakes, still making lots of mistakes, but I don't think I felt as bound by them or, you know, constrained by them. It also gave me a great chance to work with people from different cultures, particularly Timorese people who over something like 30 years had experienced huge levels of trauma and post-traumatic stress. And to be able to be a little bit more aware of what their history was and how their experiences were affecting the way that they interacted with different people. The other thing that I loved about East Timor is where it gave me a chance to rediscover bike riding. And I don't know if many people are here do much bike riding. I suspect Bill and Tony do a bit, but there was just these amazing mountain bike trails. Well, they were just normal roads for them, but for us they were wonderful trails and incredibly hilly mountains. So often we used to get our bikes taken up to the top of the mountain and then we would ride down. It was just a terrific experience. So it is cheating, that's right. It was still lots of fun. And then after that, after being in East Timor for 3.5 years, my wife and I moved to Zambia in Africa. And for those who don't know where Zambia is, if you start at South Africa and go up, you'll get to, first of all, to Zimbabwe. And then after that, you'll get to Zambia. For a while, it was Northern Rhodesia. And in Zambia, it was a similar experience in terms of international development, similar experience in terms of amazing mountain bike rides where you could ride down the escarpment towards the lower Zambezi River and risk running into elephants or them running into you. But more importantly, I think being in that environment opened up different ways of seeing the world. And I started there to think a lot more about how change happens, particularly in a different culture. I also began to realize that so much of my career had been about my efforts to change the world, to save people, to bring development, to bring change, to give people what I thought they needed, regardless of perhaps what they wanted or what they saw as their issues or how they wanted to build on what they saw as their own strength. It also gave me a lot more chance to think reflectively on my privilege as a white man, on racism, and the whole history of racism in terms of colonialism in Africa and in Zambia, and to recognize that there was something in me that actually wanted to be a bit of a savior, but also as a complement to that, to then recognize other ways of seeing the world, to recognize history and all of those things. It was there where I realized the contrast between Ubuntu and Descartes. And let me explain that. I think most people are familiar with Descartes. Descartes is the one, I don't know that he actually originally coined the phrase, but he's associated with the phrase, I think, therefore I am. And that tends to be the Western way of thinking about the world. It's up here. It's about a person, I. And it's about a logical approach, a very formal linear logical approach to say, okay, if I think this, then this is about me, and if I do this, this will happen. It's all about cause and effect. And it's a very kind of mechanical approach. And that tends to be the way that our society, the Western society, is structured. And it also tends to be, by the way, the way international development is structured. And so we have program logics and log frames and theories of change and all of those kinds of things that to a large extent have got their frame of reference out of that particular approach. When I was in Africa, I realized that that wasn't the only way of seeing the world, that there is a very strong concept called Ubuntu in Southern Africa. And Ubuntu doesn't even have one particular way of naming it. But Ubuntu is along the lines of, I am because we are. We are because I am. Still got the I am in it, isn't it? But notice the difference there. And I guess I realized that that sense of Ubuntu was the fundamental frame of reference for many people in Africa in terms of their indigenous and their cultural traditions. And that was the way that they saw the world. And that's how the world made sense to them. And so you can see a little bit of the clash, if you like. There's, you know, the white development worker coming in saying, I think, therefore I am, therefore we're going to do these things. And to paraphrase, local people who say, well, hang on, we actually need to get to know each other. You can't just be yourself. You have to be in relationship with me. We have to be together as part of that, because who you are depends on who's around you, and what who's around you depends on who you are. That's an interesting contrast, isn't it? And I've been thinking, which is the more Christian of those? Maybe I'll just leave that as a bit of a question. But I guess it made me realize that to be a development worker, I needed to be able to say the Descartes approach isn't necessarily the right one. And in fact, we're not going to get very far at all unless we recognize the pedigree, the value, and the wisdom that's in an approach like Ubuntu. And it's used a lot, by the way. Desmond Tutu refers to it a lot. I think he's one of the ones who's drawn the contrast between Descartes' approach and the Ubuntu approach. And it was very much part of that whole approach in the Commission of Truth and Reconciliation. Because as part of Ubuntu is that sense of restorative justice that they were looking for in the Commission of Truth and Justice. That also, after being in Zambia and starting to be exposed to these kinds of things, then gave me a chance to think about doing some study. And I embarked on a PhD through Deakin University. And I'm pleased to say that I just submitted it to the examiners on Tuesday, so I'm feeling a great sense of relief. Thank you. And I'm sure Bill also can relate to that sense of just this thing hanging over you. And the PhD actually gave me a chance to explore some of the things that I've just talked about, but to also explore some of the legacies of colonialism and the way, to be honest, academic research has, trodden over some of the histories and the philosophies and the cultures that are in many parts of the developing world. My research actually focused on how people living in slums or townships in South Africa, how people living in those settlements actually create change for themselves. It was incredibly inspiring to sit down with women in these communities and saying, no, this is our communities. We're not going to wait for plan or world vision or care to come and solve our problems. This is our place. We need to do this ourselves. And it was very inspiring. I hated the writing up, but the actual research was inspiring. The other thing that I've been involved in more recently is with, as Bill mentioned very briefly, the Palestine-Israel Ecumenical Network, which gave me a chance to get to know Ken Rogers, who also happened to be my late father's vicar at St. Mark's many years ago. Being involved in actually standing in solidarity with Palestinian Christians and helping their voice be raised so that the rest of the world and the rest of the global church can actually say, well, there are brothers and sisters who are affected by what's going on in Palestine, and we can't turn a blind eye. We can't treat the Holy Land as some kind of, if you like, historical Disneyland. We need to recognize it's a culture, a living culture, and if you like, the Christians in Palestine are the living stones that have maintained that heritage of Christianity for 2,000 years. And I also got involved with CBM, again with Bill, and a different way of seeing boards and governance that I've really appreciated. So in summary, that pressing the reset button and being able to do all of these other things has given me a great chance to explore new opportunities and different ideas. So what did I learn in that experience of loss and recovery? One of the things I learned is that I don't think we can expect complete answers, that we have to accept mystery sometimes. Or if you wanted an alliteration, we can't covet complete comprehension. It's unhealthy. And I do think, it'll come back to this a little bit later, it's a cultural failing to say we must understand, we must know. Well, actually, that's not necessarily ever going to happen. And I had to sit and say, I don't really understand what happened, but it happened. And I have to live with that mystery and somehow move on. And I guess one of the things that I have learned and experienced from living in cultures like Timor and in Africa is that, again, they have something to teach us in terms of acceptance of uncertainty and mystery. And they're more willing to live with it and to realize that there are things that you can't control, that there are things that you can't understand, but within that, there is a chance to be community and to move your society forward. I also learned that as part of not expecting complete answers, to learn to be part of a community, to not want to be the star, and I think I'm now much more happy to be just ordinary. I also learned that I had to change. To be honest, I wasn't sure what to change about myself or how, but I learned to try things, try different ways of seeing myself and the work that I should be focusing on. I learned not only to sit with a sense of blackness and depression, but to realize slowly, as I said, to wasn't sure of how to change, to try different approaches, that I needed to do something in response. I learned that it was the honourable, brave, courageous thing to do to reach out and say, look, I need help. I need someone who can help me carry this burden. And for me, finding a good counsellor was a hugely important step to working through some of the feelings and the issues that had hung over my head at that time, and which, to be honest, sometimes come back from time to time. Not sure what I'm up to, number three or number four. I learnt to differentiate between failure and depression. They are linked, but you can have one without the other. And both of them need to be looked at honestly. Sure, I failed, but as I mentioned before, I'm not sure that there's anything else that it would have made a difference to what happened or retrieved the situation for me. Sure, I felt bad and I needed help, but I also recognised that I had to deal with the feelings and not necessarily just the sense of failure. I also learned that it's okay to make mistakes. When it happened, to be honest, I thought, oh no, this is the end of my career. I'm never going to get a job again. And it did, I guess I assumed that employers would say, oh, look at this. Why was he only there for 12 months? And it did have an effect, I have to be honest, for some time. But over time, I noticed two things. One, that when I went for jobs, more and more employers were actually interested in what had happened and how or what I had learnt from it and how I had gone through that process. So in a sense, they saw it as a learning opportunity. The second thing I learned about it is that it's in terms of what I noticed afterwards when going for jobs is that, and talking to my mates, is that I actually think it's an incredibly common occurrence. It might be hidden, but there are many, many people who hit this big roadblock at different times in their careers and their working life. And it's easy to cover it up. It's easy to say, it's only ever happened to me, there must be something wrong with me. But in reality, it is something that we share because many of us tend to be ambitious things don't always work out. Through that, through learning how to make mistakes, I found it liberating Because, amongst other things, it actually freed me up from being so worried about other people's opinions and views. I think at the time it felt a very public form of failure, but I think in retrospect it actually gave me a chance to be able to say and do more about what I think is right, honest and true. So amongst other things, that's meant that I've really felt I need to be more involved in environmental issues. And particularly, I guess, being overseas has given me a global sense of the dangers that we're facing as a global economy, and what's happening to all of the planet, and the way that, in my view, that we're actually moving towards a bit of a precipice. And it's also the other way that, in terms of speaking up about what I think is important, the work with the Palestine-Israel Ecumenical Network. And sometimes it's easier not to speak up. It's easier not to risk conflict, particularly if you've got friends or family members who've got opposing views. And it's easier to avoid any misunderstanding. But I guess I think I'm still learning. These are issues that we need to have conversations about and we need to work towards, rather than just work towards some kind of mutual understanding, rather than just pretending that the differences don't exist. I think I've also learnt to be a bit more shrewd. And I guess one of the things I realised was I went into the whole experience a little bit naive. But in retrospect, I've learnt to be a little bit more forensic, I guess, about jobs I'm applying for and organisations. And there's nothing not wrong with shrewdness. It reminds me again of Jesus' saying about being as wise as serpents but as innocent as doves. So shrewdness can sometimes be a good quality. Lastly, I think in terms of learning to fail, I want to say a few things there. I guess I've become convinced that our culture drives expectations of exceptionalism, top performance, glorification of winning. And again, this is more apparent in terms of being out of the country and then coming back on leave. And, the TV wasn't so good in East Timor or Zambia, and there wasn't much of a... there weren't many newspapers or magazines around. So coming back and listening to talkback radio and picking up magazines, I just began to realise how much of a focus there was on saying, this is the best restaurant, you need to go there. This is a wonderful suit, you need to wear it. This person is a hero, is a star, you need to be like that person. And it seems to me there's a huge focus that we're so kind of caught up in it, but we lose track of it. There's a huge focus on consumerism, advertising, and it comes back to me to that word that I mentioned before about coveting. We're almost being encouraged to covet on a daily basis, despite it there being clear directions in the Bible against that. We're encouraged to think we can have it all. And in our culture, that leads to the sense of, well, if you can have it all, if you don't get it all, that means you're a failure. And again, I've seen that amongst my mates and even family members, where unfortunately I think some people get stuck. They're not able to move on from that roadblock. They keep on trying to do the things that they were doing when they were 30, the glory days, if you like. And it seems to me that's a really dangerous thing, dangerous in terms of mental health, dangerous in terms of, some situations of people feeling almost suicidal or it's not worth continuing because they've hit that roadblock and they can't move on. And as men, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I don't think we're good at asking for help or finding people to talk to or seeking wise counsel. For me also, I've been helped a bit by the writings of a Franciscan priest called Richard Rohr. I don't know if anyone's heard of him, who's written a lot about men's spirituality and also the spirituality of aging And I'll finish with this, but he's written a book called Falling Upwards, The Spirituality of the Two Halves of Life. And he says the first half of life is about rising, achieving, accomplishing, performing. In the second half of life, as he says, once you've created your ego structure, you finally have the courage to ask, what's this all for? What am I supposed to do with this? And he also points out that some people actually never make that transition from the first half to the second half. They, if you like, they get stuck. They just keep on thinking, I have to achieve more, I have to do those accomplishments. And you can be successful and still be stuck there. I guess I'm, in a sense, grateful that I had that chance to think about those two stages. He says that in the second half of life, there's a necessary falling that comes into every life. You don't have to manufacture or create the falling, it will happen. If you find grace or freedom in and through that falling, you find that it moves you forward, moves you upwards, broader, and to growth. And let me finish with this quote from that book and from him. So get ready for a great adventure, the one you were really born for. If we never get to our little bit of heaven, our life does not make much sense and we have created our own hell. So get ready for some new freedom, some dangerous permission, some hope from nowhere, some unexpected happiness, some stumbling stones, some radical grace, and some new and pressing responsibility for yourself and for our suffering world. Thanks very much. Yeah.
Thanks, Tim. Well, that's certainly some food for thought there. I was I had actually lunch yesterday with somebody from this church who probably sadly he couldn't be here this morning, but probably would have benefited from listening to you. But anyway, any questions for Tim? Doug?
Thanks very much, Tim. You've given us a bucket of things to think about as blokes this morning. Just returning to your terminology of Dakar and Ubuntu, did I get that right?
Ubuntu, yeah.
Is that something which you see at all mirrored in our attempts to work out reconciliation with our Indigenous people here? A different worldview, as it were, altogether. And if I could just add, at a point there, you said you sat down and talked with the women. Would you like to just unpack why you left the men out of that?
Maybe well, that's a good question. I think, Doug, that what you said in terms of the first half of it and the Indigenous way of seeing the world, I think is very important. And I think going to Africa and experiencing just a little bit of the culture there made me think about Indigenous culture here, and to read a little bit and to find out a bit more. And to understand the very different way of seeing the world and the very different way of relating. And I guess I wouldn't say that there is an absolute parallel between Ubuntu and the Indigenous Australian way of, you know, I don't know if they've got a similar phrase or something. But there are some similarities. You know, there is very much that sense of connectedness, that sense of being a mob, and very much that sense of capturing knowledge and wisdom and information in different ways. You know, it's clear to me that in Aboriginal painting and in Aboriginal songs and dances, it's not just about, you know, a pretty work of art or whatever, but that's actually a way of conveying information that has got legal implications, that's got information about geography, and it's got information about family and cultural connections. So, and we miss those kinds of insights. And I think we, you know, as a culture, we could benefit from that. So that's perhaps in response to the first half. On the second one, in terms of the women, it tended to be the women who chose to come along. So in a most of the communities that I was working in, they had savings groups where people would come in together and they would contribute a small amount of money and they'd then lend it out to each other and so on. And generally 80% of the participants were women. And I did ask, you know, where are the men? And responses varied. You know, sometimes they'd say, oh, the men are too, you know, they're out getting drunk, or they want a quick response, or they're out with a job. So there are a variety of reasons for men not. There were some men involved, but it did tend to be a women's thing. And I think that is one of the challenges and could be an interesting area to follow up. How, you know, in those contexts, how do you make sure that men aren't left out? It's also probably true to say that in the history of colonization, the men's traditional roles have been kind of cut off at the knees in terms of their part in the community. And perhaps like in Australia, I think lots of men in some cultures in Zambia and other parts of Africa are really struggling to find their own place in this kind of postmodern world that's a mixture of their own traditional cultures and a mixture of capitalism and a mixture of colonialism. So, but having said that, I've also worked with some terrific men who, you know, were very inspiring.
What's your opinion about in Africa? You've been to Zambia, to other parts of Africa, because witchcraft is quite well known in Africa. What's your opinion about it?
I think this could take weeks, if not years, to answer. I guess what I keep on reminding myself is Africa is 54 countries. Just as there's a huge variety in the countries in Asia, there is a huge variety in the countries of Africa. I don't want to be too, don't want to generalize too much. I guess from my time in Zambia, that was about 3.5 years, I came back incredibly encouraged and challenged by people's resourcefulness, some of the historical and physical barriers that they were dealing with. You know, there were some amazing strengths there, but also that there were some challenges, some of them that were historical, but some of them were also part of the, you know, the current government. There are countries in Africa where there is phenomenal economic growth, including Ethiopia, and there is substantial progress. But you know, there are obviously some countries which are struggling to kind of find their way, if you like. And Zimbabwe, I guess, is a bit of an example at the moment. The other thing I should say is, you know, I've been to Zimbabwe a number of times, and you get the sense of Zimbabwe being an absolute basket case. You know, you think it just must be a terrible place. But I went there in 2010 and went to something called the Harare International Festival of the Arts, which was an international festival that, you know, was on an international level in terms of how well organized it was, and was just this amazing cultural experience that had classical music and dance and all kinds of things. So, and they're the kinds of images or the complexity of a culture that you don't necessarily see, because you get the front page story about, you know, the 93-year-old leader or whatever.
Thanks, Tim. You're given us a good insight into the experiences that have shaped you over the years. Very helpful. What kind of other resources, theological, ecclesial community, have you really found hope and strength in over the years? And are there any ecclesial communities, you've mentioned Richard Rohr, who's in the Catholic community, that you really look to? Are there theological texts or theologians that you have found incredibly helpful that point point you to the future of hope, like where the Australian church
right.
can be more responsive? Are there glimmers of hope that you could point us to?
Yeah, there are. I for me, it's kind of, it's, I think it's a mixture of influences. So I originally did a Bachelor of Theology through Whitley College, the Baptist College, and that kind of gave me a good grounding. And I think in those years, exposure to a certain extent to some resources, but also people like Athol Gill, Ross Langmead, who some of you might be familiar with, who's unfortunately passed on, and people like Graham Garrett, who kind of influenced my way of seeing the world. More recently, I guess, I guess I see positive dimensions, not so much in necessarily in individuals, but in communities and small little things that are starting to develop. So I'm always challenged by the Sojourners community in Washington that's associated with the Jim Wallace, that's speaking out more and more in terms of justice. And there are other examples that are starting to see, I think, in Australia as well, where people are saying, as the church, we actually need to be far more intentional about being community. And what does that mean, you know, to be welcoming? And what does it mean physically about where you live and how you live? And I guess they're probably the ones that I've been thinking about mainly more recently. I must admit, I haven't been doing a lot of theological reading recently because I've been so kind of focused on a PhD. But I guess other people like Diana Butler Bass, who's been focused on theology in creation, I think, that for me has been very helpful to be reminded of God's creation, but also our role as stewards of it, amongst other things. So they'd just be some of the ones that I would kind of touch on.
Thank you, Tim. Interested, if you could elaborate a bit more, please, on the second half. The first half is about rising up and achieving. It almost sounds like you have to deconstruct yourself in the second half.
Well, I'd encourage you to read the book. And also Richard Rohr produces a daily kind of meditation thing that I always find very insightful, and that's available online. I guess in summary, Tony, I think that he's saying that the first half, if you think of your life as a container, the first half of life is about what you put inside the container. But the second half is to say, well, actually, what kind of container do I want to be? So it's very much, as far as I can tell, it's about personal ego work, and thinking much less about what I need to achieve, but who do I want to be, and what's my identity, and learning to put aside that stuff about achievement. And so that's, like, for me, that's got issues about being, having integrity, and trying to be the right person rather than, you know, thinking about what I need to do. Does that kind of... For me, that's what works, I guess, yeah.